Hey, it's spring, isn't it? I hope it is. I think it's spring. And Larry Meadler here with Garden Talk. And this is the kind of time of the year when we all get a little antsy. And Melinda Myers, are you antsy?
Oh, I think so. I was up in Eau Claire last weekend, and they were just getting their pansies in, and I had to buy a couple pots that have been sitting on my front porch, but ready to bring in case it, you know, got really, really cold. But I think they're ready for the spring, too, and so am I.
I am definitely ready for spring. And if you are listening and have a question for Melinda, and we'll talk about anything relating to spring and the garden, we can talk about some indoor plants, too. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Give us a call. You started some plants indoors, got them going? Or?
I have to confess, I've started plants from seeds in the past, but I travel so much that I've decided that it's probably better not to do it than to watch them die slowly when I go, you know, I come back from being on the road. Though I did buy a few non-hardy, some tropical bulbs. I bought an elephant ear bulb last night to use for a TV gig this morning. So it's kind of like, oh, I could pot a few of those up, get a few things. Yeah. And I actually did save a few plants over winter, which every fall, I'm like, I'm not saving anything. You know, I'm just going to let them die and then start over. But, well, I couldn't find this one, you know. So, like every good gardener, you save a few things that you don't plan. So,
yeah.
But I am getting antsy. And the garden centers are wise because they know us better. There's not a lot out there yet because they know we'll buy it and put it in the ground when we shouldn't. So, you know, there's still time to start your tomatoes and peppers if you haven't done that. You know, if you're feeling antsy, I was at a garden center last night and they had a lot of herbs in the houseplant area, and I thought, well, you know, you could start your herb container garden indoors and then, you know, take it out on those warm days like we're going to have this weekend, bring it in when it gets cold, and by the time the warm weather's here to stay, you've got a pretty good-sized herb garden in a pot.
Yeah, we started some flowers inside, which I think is much for Emily, their daughter, our four-year-old, and she's having great fun. Oh, they finally have popped up through the soil, and she gets to water, and, you know, it's a lot of fun.
It is, and I think it's a great way for those of us that have been gardening for many years to get through this last month that can be very challenging. But you bring up a good point. Flowers, vegetables, starting seeds indoors with kids is such a fun activity, teaches so many valuable lessons. You know, I always say gardening is good for teaching you patience. I'm not sure I'm any more patient, but I'm still learning how to be patient.
Well, I tell you what, our lines are filled, so let's go to the phones and see what's on Terry's mind in Appleton. Hi, Terry.
Hello, how are you today?
Great, thank you for calling.
Very good. I have a garden out in my front yard, and I use cedar mulch on it, but my plants, I have a variety of shade plants because I have three maple trees in the front. I've trimmed out the maples to allow sunshine to get in, but I cannot get the ferns just seem to wither up and kind of pass on around August or so, and none of the plants seem to get very big. And I'm wondering if I've heard that the cedar mulch can rob the soil of acid or throw off the pH balance?
Great question. A couple things with shade gardens and mulches. Wood mulches, cedar, just wood chips, shredded bark, that type of thing, break down slowly compared to leaf mold and things like that. And in the process of breaking down, the microorganisms that help break down those wood chips temporarily tie up the nitrogen in the soil. So it's a lack of nutrients. So if you like your wood chip mulch, what you may want to do is use a low nitrogen, slow release fertilizer. You know, this spring, just kind of sprinkle it over, and then I like to lightly rake the mulch to help it get to the soil. And then that will help replace. Now, I like to use a low nitrogen, slow release so that you get a little bit of nitrogen throughout. We can always add more if we decide we need to, but we can't take it away if we overdose it. And so, and with plants in the shade, they usually don't grow as fast anyway, so we don't need a whole lot of nitrogen. The other thing that can often be an issue is moisture. We think of shade as a lack of light, but often the dense canopies of things like Norway maple, some of our oaks, prevent water from reaching the soil. And then, you know, the tree gets the water first and whatever's left, the plants get. And one of the things I found is I'm a low input, not a lazy gardener, Terry, but my plants under my Norway maple street tree are a little bit slower. I try to keep after them, but I don't water as often as I should. So it takes them probably twice as long to get established and growing there than it does in the rest of my garden where they get more natural rainfall and they don't have quite the competition. So you may want to make sure that those ferns aren't getting hit by too much light since you've opened up the canopy, but it may be drought stress by that time of the season. So spot treating, watering, you know, checking the soil moisture. Go out under your tree after a heavy rain and see if the soil's dry. You know, sure. I love, because very often it is. And we don't think about that because it's just poured down rain. So check the moisture. And then I would say just a little low nitrogen slow release. So that also, if there is a moisture concern, you won't burn the roots with that slow release formulation.
And the nitrogen you can get in the, is that stuff you can get in like the granular form and just put it on there?
Yeah,
is
I'm
Miracle-Gro work? Well,
Miracle-Gro tends to be high nitrogen, quick release. Something like a Milorganite or Osmocote is a coated product, a little higher nitrogen, but it's coated to be slowly released. When you go to the fertilizer section, look at the garden fertilizer, and it should have a high percent of WIN, water insoluble nitrogen, and that's on the back. So it'd be a fertilizer, and I bet your garden center person can help you. But look for those things that are slow release. Organics are typically slow release as well.
Good luck. Thanks, Terry, for calling. Appreciate it. And Joe in Sussex is up next, I believe. So let's go there. Hi, Joe.
Yes, hi. Good morning. How are you?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Joe. Hey.
Good morning. I have an Austrian pine that I'm having problems with. It started to brown last fall, sort of from the bottom up and from the inside out, and it's getting quite worse here in the spring. I know there's a couple different diseases pines in general can be susceptible to. Is there one thing I can spray that will address both of those, or...
You know, there are two things that could be happening. There's a Zimmerman moth that really takes out a lot. That's usually at the tip, but they can also attack the trunk of the tree. And the Zimmerman moth lays its egg and the caterpillar burrows inside the tree. If you look at the trunk of the tree or any of the branches and you see this orangish globular stuff, then you know that that's the problem. And you can time your sprayings. A late summer spray, which I think it's when the hydrangeas go from white to green, is when you'd spray it. But those are often big trees, and you need to make sure that you're not going to end up with more product on you than you are in the tree. And there's a lot of surface area of needles, so it's hard to get good penetration. So I really, if you're going to spray an evergreen, I'd bring in a professional. That's the Zimmerman moth. The other problem that we most often see is... I always get rhizosphera or, I'm having one of those moments. Rhizosphera needle blight, Soropsis or rhizosphera. It's rhizosphera. I had to think of it. One's on spruces and one's on the pines. And it's a disease you can treat when the needles are half expanded with a fungicide. And then again, when they're fully expanded. But again, what we're finding out is there's a source. They overwinter, the fungi overwinters in these little hard bodies called sclerotinias or pycnidias on the cone. So if you lift up a cone of an Austrian pine, you'll see little black spots on it. Those are dormant forms of the spores that will be there to reinfect the tree. So raking out, getting that debris out from underneath the tree, okay, is one option. Spraying when the needles are half expanded and then fully expanded, proper watering. We've had a really dry summers, and we find that trees are more susceptible to disease problems when we have a drought. So you want to make sure your trees are properly watered. A lot of people have just said, you know what, I'm going to let my Austrian pine just kind of go, and I'll replace it either sooner or later with something that tends to be more resistant. So I would definitely look for an option.
That.
Yeah, Austrian pines are just, they're beautiful trees, but they're really, they have so many problems in our area that if it's already showing that much sign of decline, you might be better off just kind of letting it fade away and replacing it.
Thanks, Joe, for calling. Adam in Rockford, Illinois is up next, so let's go to Adam. Hi, Adam.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had a lot of my question answered by the gentleman wondering about mulch, but I wondered if you could give some alternatives to using hardwood mulch. You know, we like the, my wife and I like the low maintenance and the water retention of mulches and stuff, and I was just wondering, should we maybe look at using something like maybe a straw or hay to use, or would that still tie up a lot of those the microbes or whatever that are breaking down and holding out the nitrogen. And I can take my answer off
before
the
you
air.
Do. Before you leave, what kind of garden is this? A flower bed under trees, under shrubs, or vegetable garden?
It's a vegetable garden, and it's out. It's got pretty much full exposure.
Okay.
And we've got very very rich soil.
Wonderful.
But like I say, we've had some stunted growth of tomatoes. And a couple different types of vegetables and stuff. So I was just curious if there were any alternatives to that hardwood mulch that we could use to retain moisture.
Yeah, great question. And one of the things I like to use my wood mulches is pathways around trees and shrubs, because then you typically don't see as many problems with the nitrogen deficiency. I really don't like using wood chips in annual gardens, whether they're flowers or vegetables, because what do you do at the end of the season? You remove the old plants, often you till, the wood ends up in there, and then you end up with problems. I was just at Old Brook Botanic Garden here in Madison this morning, getting a little taste of spring, and they use a lot of leaf mold, and that's one of my favorite mulches. Mm-hmm. I think it's pretty. It's a great way to recycle our leaves. It's free for most of us because you rake them up. You can shred them with your mower. You can store them in a bag or use them, you know, on your perennial gardens right away. Evergreen needles are also a good mulch. You know, if you have a lot of evergreens, looks pretty, easy to walk on. Straw or marsh hay, make sure it's weed free. And that's kind of the biggest problem.
And hard to make sure it's weed free.
It is, until you find out you get weeds, because I bought some that I thought was weed free and ended up pulling a few extra weeds. The other thing I've used are grass clippings. Now, they break down quickly, but if you have not used a weed killer or a chemical, you know, if your lawn is chemical free, take those grass clippings and you can put it on the soil surface. I've also used newspaper, a couple layers of newspaper, under my mulch, whether it's leaves or needles, for an extra layer of protection. And then that newspaper breaks down, adds organic matter, and then the needles or the leaves break down eventually, or at the end of the season, you till them in and it works really great.
Mm-hmm.
So there's lots of free stuff in our own yards to look for, too.
Thanks a lot for calling, Adam. Holly in Shiocton wanted to know what type of shallow-rooted plants she could grow on a small mound she just built, but unfortunately, I don't know if she's got vegetables or flowers or what she's got in mind.
Okay. And you know, I always get very nervous when we get into the mound system because I feel like I need somebody who's an expert on the whole septic mound system. So feel free to chime in.
It is flowers, apparently.
Oh, okay. Because I was going to say, well, grasses work great. You know, lawn grass mm-hmm. is often the choice because you can mow it, you can keep it down. You could even do a no-mow kind of setting and maybe even some bulbs in addition, you know, where you use like fescue, some of the fine fescues, like the red fescues, and you just let them grow and it kind of gives you a meadow. Like appearance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the prairie grasses are typically, and plants are typically deep rooted. So those are definitely those to avoid. If it's, oops, sorry, son, you know, you might want to look for sedums or things like that that tend to creep along the ground and tend to be ground covers. For shady areas, coral bells, which can take some sun too, but if you've ever grown them, they are very shallow rooted. So you might want to look for things that a lot of the ground covers as well and then pop in a few flowers. Bulbs typically aren't very deeply rooted. Again, some of your sedums, you could make a nice tapestry and then have flowers as well.
All right, on to Stephanie and Toma. Hi, Stephanie.
Hi. I planted 5 years ago some maple shrubs that on the tags said they could be trimmed into trees. And they've kind of taken over my garden, and I'd like to trim them into trees, but they don't have any main stems. Their stems go all over the place. So I was wondering what the deal is, how do you trim those?
Okay, and I was paying attention, but what kind of plant again?
Maple.
Maple
They're
tree?
Maples.
Okay. I'm wondering if it's an amur maple, maybe?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
Typically with amur maples, they train them. You can train them single stem, but you usually see them three-stemmed doing it. And what you're going to need to do, and this is going to be really tough, is pick one. If you want a single trunk, is you're going to need to pick one, and I'd probably pick the one that's the straightest. And then you're going to have kind of a goofy-looking plant, probably, because it's been shaded out. And then you're going to have to train the top to give it the appearance that you're looking for. If these are young plants and there's three stems or four stems, then it won't be such an issue. But I'd pick the one that's growing the straightest. Even if it's crooked over time, it'll straighten up. And then you're going to need to do a little shaping to get that canopy going.
Okay.
But typically,
can I take that much off in 1 year, or should I?
The good question. How tall is this again?
Oh, they're probably 6-7 feet tall.
And how many stems do you have coming
out? Oh, gazillions.
Gazillions. Okay. What you may want to start doing is to take all the skinny ones down right to the ground level.
Okay.
And then I would try to take maybe the ones closest to the center. It's going to look a little goofy this first year or two. We typically don't like to take more than a third of the total growth off.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do this over time, but you do too much, you probably won't kill the tree. What you'll do is stimulate lots of growth because you have all this root system supporting what you used to have growing on top. So if you cut the whole thing back, you probably get really hundreds of shoots. If you try to start training it, you know, you may want to reduce the height of those stems next to the main one this first year. Okay, that you start letting that canopy grow and get the sunlight and develop, or maybe reduce the height of everything, take all the really tiny ones out, then next year take the others back to the ground level once that main stem is starting to form a canopy.
Okay.
You know, 2 to 3 years, better for the plant, patience on your part. It's going to look a little ugly short term.
Okay.
Thanks, Stephanie.
Yep, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Melinda Meyer is our guest on this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, Keisha Mabra here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller, Keisha Mabra answering the phones today, and our guest, Melinda Myers of Milwaukee, who hosts the public PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener. She's written several books, including Can't Miss Small Space Gardening, Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin, to name a couple. And really pleased to have her with us today. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. Melinda, we should also mention your website because you speak a lot and go around a lot, and there's a lot of that on the website.
You bet. It's okay. there we go. It's MelindaMyers.com, and I do tips twice a month. We also have Melinda's Garden Moments, which are 54-second tips, and they air throughout Wisconsin and Minnesota and the Great Lakes region. So you can see them on TV, but you can also check out on my website. And I do post places I'm going to be traveling. So it's a lot of fun. It's great when people come up and go, oh, I read you were going to be in the area, and come up and say hello. Or they tell me they, you know, they're regular listeners of yours and heard me on the radio and joined me. So exactly. And we also have a new, relatively new gallery called What's Blooming. And we invite gardeners to send their photos to the website so we can post them, because I find gardeners always like to know what's going on in your garden. And we just rearranged it by month to make it a little easier to use. And then we also have a gallery on landscape makeover so that professionals and home gardeners can submit pictures. We have quite a few of walkways. County Material sponsored that one. Walkways, retaining walls, drives. So if you're looking to do over your landscape, you can sit down, get a few ideas before you start digging or before you hire a professional. And then I'm going to put in a plea for children across the state and around your listening areas, growing sunflowers. I think we all have good memories. You're talking about your daughter starting flowers inside. Well, if you've got kids that are interested, email me at info@MelindaMyers.com, and I have an activity book, and I'll have to send you one. I meant to bring one in for you. And I'm trying to get kids to grow sunflowers and then send pictures of those sunflowers in, and we'll post them on the website. I had a grandmother work with her 15 grandkids over Easter, and she sent me photos, and the younger ones were excited, and the older ones had that look that everybody with teenagers will recognize, like, okay, Grandma, are we done yet? But I think deep down they were all having fun. So hopefully it's a fun way we can get kids of all ages excited about growing this summer.
MelindaMyers.com, and Myers is M-Y-E-R-S.
Right, thank you.
And here we go to Christy in Elan now. Christy, hi to you.
Hello. I was wondering if you had any luck with overwintering geranium.
You know, geraniums are really tough to keep over winter. The way I've had the most success is one of two ways. Either taking cuttings the end of the season. Now, the best time to do it is August and September, when the plants are nice and lush and they root quickly, and, you know, you just rinse them off so you don't bring insects and disease in. But like most gardeners, I'm usually out there the night before the killing frost taking my cuttings of things I'm going to root, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I like cuttings because they're smaller and they don't take up as much growing space indoors. You can bring the whole plant in and grow it like a house plant. Now, you can bring insects in and disease problems in, and it does take up more room. Now, the last method is letting them go dormant. My basement is really too warm to do that, like so many. I do have one area I've tried and had some success occasionally, but the idea is you bring them inside, either take them out of the soil and store them bare root or leave them in the pot. Miss the roots occasionally so the plant doesn't die, but it doesn't grow. But it's you got to have a root cellar kind of environment, moist, humid, cool conditions. And if you did that, if you haven't already, it's time to pot it up. Cut it back and start watering and hopefully get it growing for the season. Have you had some good luck doing that? Or
We kind of lost her.
Well, Christy, hopefully if you did and you didn't have luck, blame the basement, okay?
Okay.
Because that's the case for most people. And then maybe try the cuttings next year.
Ken in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Ken.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
25 years ago, I had a landscaper put in about 18 pyramidal arborvitaes that were great at the time. They're multi-trunked. I don't even know if it's considered a bush or a tree. But in that 25 years, they've grown very large. They're between 25 and 30 feet tall. But the kicker and the problem that I'm having is the width on these things or the diameters have encroached so much on my backyard patio brick that I can't use it anymore. And I was wondering, Linda, if I trim these, am I just going to basically expose the trunks and have no greenery to look at because it won't regrow?
They can eventually regrow, but you're going to be looking at those brown stems all this summer and possibly next summer. They don't resprout as quickly as yews do, but they're better than most junipers. What you may, and I, you know what, I hate to ever be putting a plant to death, but at some point you may say, maybe I'm better off removing them or every other. Is there any way to remove it in a way that you can keep a few for privacy, then maybe pop in some ornamental grass or something else to add some screening so that you take advantage of the fact that they're nice and big and they're tall and they're beautiful and mature. But, you know, the fact they're encroaching your patio, it sounds like it's a lot of severe pruning you're going to have to do that I think you're going to end up looking at some ugly stems for quite a while.
Yeah, my attempt in doing this was to hide a terraced multi-car apartment garage behind us. And now with the height of these and how they've grown out, if I cut that back, all I'm going to see is this garage. And, as I said, these things are so tall with the severe winter we've had, they were bent over so bad I could touch the top, but they sprung back real well. But they are kind of open at the top like an inverted umbrella, so to speak. So I just don't know whether to have them cut down and start all over or to try to trim them back like a foot this year and then a foot next year. And
it's probably going to be every couple of years
because
if you're going to want them to regrow. What if you, and the deer usually do this for most people, and I'm usually not a fan of this, but what if you limbed them up and put something shade tolerant smaller underneath? Would that work? You know, only you could tell looking at it.
Give me a suggestion of what you would put in there if you were doing it.
You know, there's some really cool dwarf hemlocks. Gensha's White is a pyramidal upright. There's a new arborvitae, but you probably want the height, right?
Not necessarily. I really don't want anything that's taller than 15 feet, to be honest with you.
Okay. So, and that was one of the, like the Holmstrup and the Techne, and there's some fastigiatas that are narrower upright. But if it's full sun area, there's some junipers that are narrow and upright.
Mm-hmm.
Lattice with vines is often a great way. Takes up very little space. You can do annual vines this first year. Like it's called hyacinth bean vine. Lob is its botanical name. For real.
Oh, wow.
I know. And it gets leaves like a bean, really pretty purple flowers and purple pea pods, bean pods, very decorative, fast growing. And then you could put a perennial vine in. And if you use like a lattice fencing, you'd have the screening from that, the stems from the vine in the winter, but then the leaves and the flowers during the growing season. that would give you some screening. And I think that way you'd have a little more control. And anytime you had to do severe pruning on your vines, they grow back pretty quickly. So I think that might be a long-term solution for
sure.
You.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Good,
yeah. Appreciate it.
Good luck. It's a hard decision to make to ever cut a healthy plant down.
Yeah, especially a big tree.
Mm-hmm.
Patty in Madison, it is your turn. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I have two areas that I need some help in. One is the large amount of deer this winter have stripped our cedars and our pines, some of the pines, the trees and the bushes, to where there's just a few branches that have needles on them anymore. And I'm wondering what I can do to save these.
Okay. Cedars, if they're the soft ones, which I'm guessing they are because those are more favored, are really a type of arborvitae. And as we were mentioning before, that sometimes you end up with problems that it takes years for them to grow back. And the same and with pines and spruces, those are terminal growers. So if the deer have eaten all of the green tips and there are no buds on the stems, those branches are pretty well shot. Now, I've seen spruces sprout from the trunk, but it takes years. And then you have these short stubby things at the bottom and bigger branches on top. So what you're going to have to do is take a look and go, okay, if I clean up that arborvitae, what's left, and it's going to take years to come back, or am I better off to start over again? The rabbit damage is also very bad this year. So as the snow melted, I think we're seeing a lot of creamy bark. Fortunately for multi-stem shrubs, you can cut those back and often they'll resprout. So there's nothing you can do but proper care, and that's watering during drought. If you did a lot of salting in the area or those plants were exposed to road salt, you know, we've had some good rain so far this spring, so that's helping to leach it through. But make sure if we move into a drier period, you're watering properly. If they're not mulched, that's all you can really do. Fertilizing isn't really going to help. There's lots of stored nutrients in the root system. You know, it may make you feel better, but it's not going to make the plants come back. So it's really a matter of how patient are you, and would you rather start over and wait for the plant to catch up in size, or hopefully, and it's hard without seeing it to tell if it's going to recover, but you know, it sounds really bad, and maybe it isn't, but you need to look at it and go, can I live with this throughout the summer and possibly for several seasons to come?
Well, being we planted them as a screen, I'm afraid I might have to
Right, and you know, the other thing is often what the browse line is up, what, 4 or 5 feet or 6 feet, depends on how hungry and how high they reach. And again, if you've got space, maybe it's putting ornamental grasses in front of it if the sunlight gets in there, and that will help screen it as well. Or if you decide to take them out, can you do something, you know, spider cleome grows 4 to 5 feet tall. Is that tall enough for the screen? Maybe, maybe not. But can you do some temporary things either to cover that bare bottom, or if you do replanting for something more permanent, use some temporary plants that you can move. Those grasses, as the evergreens grow that you use to replace them, move those perennial ornamental grasses to another area, and that might give you that temporary screen until your new planting fills in. Or if you could add something with what was damaged, and maybe you could mask it and still have the bigger plants in place and something smaller to fill in where the deer have eaten.
That's a good idea. Thanks.
You bet. Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Joya in Fitchburg. Hi, Joya.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Mary,
I have a question for her. Now the snow is receding, and I can see the ground.
Yay, isn't it great?
Right. I had some crown veg, which was planted several years ago. It started, it's in the full sun area. It started growing on the, you know, like a weed. So last year I changed some plants, and I tried to do it manually. They kept on coming back. So eventually one of your colleagues told me you have to use Roundup, and I did kill them with the Roundup, most of them. But now I see some of them are peeping up again.
Yeah, Crown Vetch used a lot along the highways and the freeways, and for a long time, and they still sell it as a ground cover, but as you found, it's invasive and a weed, and it's hard to kill. Mm-hmm. And I want to put a plug in for the Department of Natural Resources website. They have a great portion of their website on invasives, including invasive plants and ways to manage them. So anybody out there that's maybe driving going, I couldn't remember it, you're going to need to, it's going to take several years. There are a couple things. If you don't want to use chemicals, strategic mowing may help. You know, mowing in the spring as it comes up, and again, you know, throughout the season, sometimes can help starve the plant. If it's not able to keep putting out leaf growth, it's one way to then prevent it from putting energy back in, and then also from setting seed. Roundup is very effective, as you know, and others, that Roundup or Finale, total vegetation killers, and they'll kill the tops and the root system, but they'll kill anything green they touch. There's a lot of seed in that ground, and that's why it's going to take a while for you to take care of it. And so mulching the area, I'm not sure what else you're doing there, but what you may want to do is kill what's coming up and mulch it with, you know, maybe some newspaper and then some wood chips or shredded leaves or grass clipping or whatever for a year or two if it doesn't look too unsightly. And then anytime that crown vetch makes it through, you can knock down the plants, or you can then interplant, leaving that mulch in place to try to give the new planting a jump start over that crown vetch. Yeah.
I can do the new planting on top of the mulch. I already put some mulch last fall.
You're going to need to dig a hole. You'll need to pull back the mulch and dig through that. But yes, then you can put that plant in there. And then, you know, you'll probably, a gardener I met called them the tongs of death. And they take tongs and put sponges on the end, and then they dip it in the proper concentration of Roundup, kind of, you know, squeeze off the excess and wipe it on the weed. And that's one way to put it on the weed and not on your plant. Or take a milk jug with the bottom cut off, place it over the crown vetch if you have to spray and you have good plants in the area. So it's one way to be able to keep working on that crown vetch and still introduce some new plants.
Mm-hmm. Good luck.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Patty in Madison, who was on, was also wondering what to add to soil to eliminate moss buildup in her yard, which is surrounded by oak trees. It was originally a clay soil yard, and topsoil has been added over the years to improve the soil condition, but I suspect it's the oak trees that are creating the problem.
Yeah, moss is a problem with heavy shade, acid soils, which not all of us in Wisconsin have acidic soils and still get moss, poor drainage, and heavy soils. So you may read in gardening books to add lime. Do not add lime unless you know your soils are too acidic. You're right, Larry. It's probably the shade of the oak trees. And, you know, moss gardens have become quite hip and trendy. So my thought is you tell your friends you did it on purpose, just like they read it in, you know, some of those, you know, trendy garden magazines. You can kill it, but it'll come right back if you don't improve the conditions. It sounds like you've got good drainage. If you've been amending the soil, your oak trees, you know, it's a trade-off. I'll vote for the oaks, you know, because they've been around for a long time and we'd like to keep them. If you decide to thin the canopy, hire a certified arborist. You know, you really don't want to prune your oak trees. I don't like to prune them any time during the growing season.
Can't prune them now.
Right, exactly. It's too late now because then you open them up to oak wilt disease. So if possible, try a mulch. Try shade tolerant ground covers. Try embracing the moss. I visited gardens that people took moss from friends and put it in their blender, created a slurry and spread it on their grass, you know, on their ground, their bare ground. So it can be pretty. I know not if you're trying to grow grass. So, you know, I think you're better off leave the trees intact. Try, if you can't stand it, try mulching the area. That's one way to keep the mud down, and you'll still probably get moss coming through, but it may be less annoying.
Robert in Nina is up next. Hi, Robert.
Yes, I have a question concerning the old problem of black walnuts.
Yeah. Okay.
And I've already given up on my garden. I have a very small side yard, and I've just planted it in perennials, coneflowers, and various things, which seem to do okay there. But right around the oak, or around the black walnut, I have a spruce tree, a sugar maple, a scarlet oak, and a pear tree, and I'm just wondering if that black walnut is going to affect any of those trees.
Spruces will somewhat make it. Some maples do tolerate it. A lot of times with are these established trees?
Yes.
Okay. A lot of times what you'll see with larger plants, if you go into a wooded area and you'll find a black walnut, you'll see plants growing around it, but they're much more stunted. Now, being that these plants are huge, the problem happens when the roots make contact with the roots of the black walnut or the fruit or the nuts or whatever. There's really nothing you can do to prevent it if it's not your tree, which I'm guessing maybe that's the case.
No, it's my tree.
No, it is your tree, but you want to keep it.
Well, I'd like to, but okay. It can affect the other trees. It's not that huge. It's maybe like 20 feet tall.
You know, I would probably err on the side of getting rid of the black walnut, which won't get rid of all of the juglone out of the soil immediately,
right,
but
yeah.
You won't be adding to it. The side I would recommend, and I'll just be honest, I don't trust my memory like I used to. So I would Google black walnut or go, you know, surf the internet for black walnut toxicity. Ohio State University has one of the most comprehensive lists. I think Purdue also and Penn State. And those are usually the top ones that come up. Now, here's the deal. What I found as I've searched over the years, it's mostly observational. People saying, well, I've seen these grow, I've seen these die. And so there's not a truly, you know, be-all, end-all list. But I think those are good places to start. And I would start there and just double-check to make sure my memory's correct. I think some spruces will tolerate, some maples will. The calorie pear, the rose family in general tends to be sensitive, and the calorie pear's in the rose family. So I would double-check that. And then that might help you make that decision.
Good.
Okay? Best of luck.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Robert, for calling. And Ed in River Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Ed.
Hi. I have a question about currant bushes. This year the snow packed them down pretty good, so they're leaning over. How short to the ground can I cut those off?
Now, are these the ornamental currants or edible currants?
Ornamental currants.
Okay.
The bush.
Okay.
Hedge
the hedge. Okay. Those are hedges that can be sheared and they can be cut back pretty far. You know, you're right. As the snow's melting, we're finding out what's popping up and what isn't.
Sure.
And so there are a couple ways you can manage it. You can take the whole hedge down, or you can start with taking down the ones that are broken and damaged first. And then that'll open it up and encourage new growth at the base. And then next year, if you need to take more down, by doing that, you end up getting growth from top to bottom. Sometimes when we take everything down, we get really a big push of growth, and then it tends to be wider at the top, and then it'll thin out at the bottom. So by doing it over a longer period of time, we encourage new growth at the base as we're thinning the top, and you end up getting green growth from top to bottom. If everything's broken, prune it back.
Yep.
And it'll come back. It'll definitely come back.
I've noticed a lot of little new ones on the bottom.
Yeah. So, which is always a good sign. It makes it easier to do that heavy duty pruning, doesn't it?
Thanks, Ed.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Appreciate the call. Melinda Meyer is our guest today, host of the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener. And I am Larry Mueller here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with my guest today, Melinda Myers, author of Month by Month Gardening in Wisconsin. Can't miss small space gardening. Take a look at her website at melindamyers.com. She's got lots of great information on it. And if you have a question for us right now, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Mike in Seneca is up next. Mike, hello.
Hey, Larry. Thank you.
Hi, Mike.
Hey, I've got a scenario for your guest.
Okay.
I've got a really tall white cedar and some junipers. The deer got in them.
Mm.
We had a lot of shortage of food down here.
Mm-hmm.
They literally, I would say, 5 to 6 feet off the ground, it looks like a skeleton. They just ate everything. Now the junipers, it must have not have tasted too well. They didn't. They just ate tips off the.
Yeah, usually balls. They're pretty resistant.
But my question is to you is, will this grow back, and how much should I prune now? The limbs, it gives me a good idea where I was behind on trimming. I couldn't get in there. No.
Now you can, huh?
But how, you know, will it grow back?
Usually with junipers and arborvitae, they're very slow to resprout on old wood. You know, if there are some stems left, you might get some regrowth, but it's going to take a while. I mean, you can kind of, as I was driving in this, well, not this morning because it was pretty dark when I came in, but as I was driving around today, this morning, it was, you could definitely see where the deer have done damage. And typically, that's the way those plants look for the rest of their lives. So it takes a long time. So it's one of those things where, you know, because they're being shaded from above, you might get some regrowth either from those stems left or the trunk, but it's going to take a while. And so you may be at that point we've talked about with a few other people about, would it make sense to plant something underneath it or in front of it if you're looking for screening to try to change that look? If you're waiting for it to resprout, I just prune any broken, damaged, you know, get good clean cuts and do a wait and see. But you might be waiting to see for a couple of years and nothing may come back. You know, if you've ever seen junipers that have been sheared up to make those little cloud junipers, you don't see a whole lot of sprouting coming out of that wood. And again, with the arborvitae that you see that the deer have limbed up, you don't typically see a lot of sprouting coming out of that main stem. So, you know, you might be at that point where can you change your landscape plan and kind of embrace that as a new addition and kind of plant around it, whether it's, you know, tall perennials and annuals, ornamental grasses, some shorter shrubs, so that you have kind of a layered shrub effect. If you got the room, you could do that and bring your planting out in front so you don't have to look at those bare trunks.
Yep. Good luck, Mike. Thank you very
much. Yeah, I know. I think you probably hung up and going, man, I was hoping for something better.
Well, here's one that might not involve killing anything.
Okay, good.
Oh, man. Linda in Superior emailed us and wonders, how do I plant over a bulb garden for blooms after the bulbs are done, of course, without disturbing the bulbs?
You know, that's a great question, Linda. And as the bulbs are coming up and you know, they always look beautiful, and then the foliage starts to decline, and we're like, oh, that's not looking so good. What I like to do is I mix my bulbs with a lot of perennials, because then as the foliage fades, my perennials come in, it reduces my workload, and then it minimizes the digging I do in there. You can also interplant with annuals. If you start planting and leave that faded foliage or mark the area, then you can plant around them, and then the annuals will fill in over top. Now, many of your bulbs like to go a little bit drier during the summer, so it's good to use plants that maybe aren't moisture loving, or make sure you're growing things like the checkered lily if you want to have a moist area, so that if you've got to keep it wet. You can do it, just do it carefully. The good news is if you dig up your bulbs, put them right back in the soil. I've cut them in half and I put both halves back, because sometimes one or both will be enough to start to produce a full blooming bulb in a couple years. Worst case, it decomposes and adds organic matter to the soil. So, you know, I think plants are a lot tougher. Just dig gingerly and then just replant anything that you pop out of the soil.
Ruth in Michicot, we're to you now. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. I have actually two questions, and I'll take the answer off the air. When Melinda discussed mulches, she didn't mention using cocoa bean mulch and what that does to the nitrogen level. And then the other question is in relation to the nitrogen level. I do what you just discussed about bulbs and perennials. So now I'm going to sprinkle a little of the bulb fertilizer on. Then when the perennials come, you know, and I always use the wood mulch, do I do the slow-release nitrogen again, or how do I deal with that? So I'll take my question off the air because I'm on a cell phone.
Okay.
Ruth, great questions, and thank you, and good follow-up. I didn't mention cocoa bean shells for a couple reasons. It's one of my favorite mulches, but you have to be careful if you have dogs, because dogs are attracted to chocolate, and this is the extent of my dog biology, but it can be harmful and make them either sick or can kill them. I've had reports from vets where they've done autopsies and found a gut full of cocoa bean shells. So if you have dogs, you may want to avoid it. I think it's a pretty mulch. Sometimes you'll get slime mold on any of your mulches, particularly that, so often mix it with rice hulls. I don't find it tying up the nitrogen as much. I've used it a lot on my flower beds, dug it into the soil. It's slow to break down, but it doesn't seem to, it doesn't react the same way that the wood chips do. Now, so let your plants be your guide, and that kind of goes into that next question with your bulbs and your perennials. I've used twice shredded mulch. I've used wood chip mulch. I use leaves when I can find. It's kind of whatever I have easier access to. And with perennials and bulbs, if you're not digging up the ground, it stays on the soil surface. I don't find as much problem as I do with annual flowers and vegetables. However, if my plants are stunted, that's when I'll come in and add a little low nitrogen slow release, say a cup of a low nitrogen fertilizer per 100 square feet if you haven't had a soil test. If your plants aren't looking like you expect them to or aren't doing as well, if you're doing bulb fertilizer, that may be enough to feed your perennials as well. So, you know, if your plants are doing great, I wouldn't worry. If you're seeing some stunting, some yellowing, then I would start with a cup of a low nitrogen fertilizer per 100 square feet. That'd be a starting point. Mm-hmm. You can always add more. You can't take it away. So I would try that. The other thing that I, the professional design, landscape designers, someone who'd spoke at one of their conferences a few years ago talked about putting compost under wood chips so that you've got a natural source of nitrogen. So obviously you're not going to take your wood chips off and put the compost down, but before you put your next flush of wood chips down, you know, after these have broken down, you might want to put down some compost, then put your wood chips on top. And that might be a way to then reduce the need for additional fertilizer.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And let's see, we've got Courtney in Oshkosh wrote an email. She says she's testing my garden soil for the first time this year with a kit that tests the acidity and the fertility of her soil. When should she first use her soil test kit? Can she do it now? She plans to test it once, fix problems, then test it a second time.
Okay. Well, Courtney, a soil test are always a good idea. I tend to steer towards the state certified labs, University mm-hmm. Extension Lab, because they have equipment and chemicals they use that have been standardized, so we know that the test is always going to be consistent and right. Some of the home test kits, there's a lot of room for error, how they've been stored, how they've been shipped, and then you need to make sure you follow the directions. You can't lose anything by testing your soil. Just if it sounds really out of whack, then I would get it tested at the state lab or the University Extension soil testing lab, and your extension office can help you with that. But what I would do, as soon as the ground is workable, it's okay to do your testing.
Mm-hmm.
And then if it's an area where you've had a lot of salt that might have washed in, you might want to do a little bit of wait for that salt to leach through, because then you'll get a high soluble salt reading, which may not be true. It may be temporary. So if it's right next to a sidewalk or someplace where you salt heavily, you might want to give it a little more time for some of that salt to wash through the soil before testing. But as soon as you can get into your soil, this is a great time to test, because you can maybe beat the spring rush. I don't know. We might be in it with the snow melting. I think every gardener's out there doing whatever they can. But, you know, testing now the top 4 to 6 inches where the root zone is, several areas within that garden, garden by garden, it's a great way to give you a good baseline. Do you need to test your soil every year? No. What you want to do is test new gardens, areas you've had problems. If you've never tested your soil, then repeat that. You know, like you were mentioning, Courtney, you make your corrections. If they were minor, then I would wait 3 to 4 years to retest it. If there were some major problems, then you might want to test it in the next year or two to make sure things have been corrected.
Mm-hmm. And you might use your test kit this time around, and then if you're going to follow up sometime, then use the testing lab. That'd be a way to do it, too.
Exactly. And for those that are science buffs as well as gardeners, you might want to test it, and you might want to send a sample in and then kind of do a compare.
That's a great idea. Great idea. Mary in Sugar Island, it is your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi. Well, I was going to say, we cut our own marsh hay because we have lots of marshland, and we really like it. We put it around our rhubarb. And we don't have any problems with the weeds.
Right. And Mary, it's probably good you're on the phone, because everybody want your phone number now. Because basically why they always talk about marsh hay is those are wetter areas. So typically the weed seeds, if there are any that come in, aren't going to be in your garden because it's drier. So thanks for bringing that up, because I don't know that everybody often knows that's one of the differences with marsh hay and why you often hear marsh hay. So lucky for you, we're all a little green with envy.
And we put that around our tomatoes, and and we had really good luck, and I did not need to do much watering in the drought last summer at all, you know.
Oh, and it's a great mulch if you have a good source like you do. That's excellent.
And my other question is some advice on controlling cucumber beetles and squash bugs, because they're always a pain.
Yeah.
Well, and you often find them in the flowers. So anything mm-hmm. you're doing is spraying where the bees are going to go and do pollinating.
Right, that's the problem. I know.
This is where, if you have kids in the neighborhood,
yeah,
hand picking bugs, dropping them into soapy water. You know, the beetles. I don't think there are any of the BTs that will work on the cucumber beetles that I'm aware of, and the same with the squash bug. And so it's really a matter of, boy, you know, I don't know that Phil's come. I haven't seen anything that's really any good solution, because once they're blooming, you're really not going to want to use anything.
No.
I've done a lot of work. I'm really trying to grow gardeners and kids and get them excited. And you know what? They like bugs and worms mm-hmm. and soil. And I found that when I've traveled around the country and visited kids' gardens, they're usually out there picking the insects. We're all going, ooh, yuck, you know. And this is where kind of those kids that like the ooey gooey gross things in life can shine in the garden, maybe. So, I, you know, there are chemicals labeled for it, but I just worry about killing the bees and their habitat.
Yeah, I know. That's a problem. I did try the floating roll covers over some of the cucumbers for a while to try and see if that helps some. But after a while, I mean, it got so bad here because I had, you know, pumpkins and I had gourds, and I was like, okay, it's only as a last resort, and then maybe I would do it later in the day so the bees wouldn't, you know, and try to be careful.
And you might, and you might try something like the neem, N-E-E-M as in Mary, that might be a little gentler on the bees. Some of those products, all your insecticides, bees are insects, so it can kill them. And floating row covers are great until you need to pollinate. So,
right, I know.
Okay, and only because I want to make sure you know that, but if somebody covers their plants and they don't get any, you know, fruit, and they're going to be yelling at me going, well, I did that. But you have to either be the bee and go in there and hand pollinate it with a paintbrush, or open it up at that point and really slow down the process like you tried. But I would look for some of those more environmentally friendly. There's some oils out there, pyola oil, some of those things that might, you know, check, read and follow the label direction carefully before using them. And the labels change. I check every year when I recommend a product. I pull
they
out.
Change.
They change, and they're finding new things all the time. So, you know, we'll pose that question to Phil next time he's on.
We will. We will do that. Melinda Meyer is our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, horticultural expert extraordinaire, Melinda
Meyer.
Well,
that's Myers. A lot of pressure.
Melinda Myers with us. Take a look at her website, too, by the way. Again, Melinda Myers, M-Y-E-R-S, MelindaMyers.com. All of her books, where she's speaking, lots of great information. Chance for you to send in some pictures of your flowers and landscape and so forth. So there's a lot there, and I hope you'll look at it. It's really a nice interactive website. And she's also here to answer your questions, and every line's filled. So let's go to Cecilia.
Okay, we'll talk fast.
Yeah, Cecilia in Gurney, Illinois. Hello.
Hello.
Hi, Cecilia. How can I help?
We removed junipers. What happened is what other people said. It's the north side of the house. It's about 15 feet long. It's landscape planting, and it gets almost total shade. It's maybe 2 hours in the morning of morning light, and we want to know what to replace it with, and want something that won't go above the window, so that would be about 5 feet.
Okay.
What have you grown in that area? Have you had success growing anything, or it was just junipers and nothing else?
It was just junipers, and across from it, maybe, you know, 20 feet from the house is a row of crab apples.
Are you okay doing something deciduous, something that loses its leaves?
In the winter? Because we don't look at it in the winter. So.
Okay, great. Well, that gives us a lot more choices. That's good news. Okay, a couple of things that I would suggest. There's a viburnum, the arrowwood viburnum, Viburnum dentatum. It's a native. It's resistant to the viburnum borer that we're seeing hit some of the mm-hmm. viburnums. Shade tolerant. It has white flowers. They're not fragrant. They smell. Okay. So you wouldn't want to put it right outside your window, but usually it's early enough in the spring. You've got them shut. Wonderful fruit that the birds eat. Beautiful blueberries. Great fall color. Now in heavy shade, it may not get as good a fall color, but they'll take, pardon me? Yeah. Okay. So arrowwood viburnum is one. The other one is aronia. I would use the black choke blackberry, Aronia melanocarpa, A-R-O-N-I-A is the genus. And the black-fruited one is a little shorter. The red-fruited one gets taller. You may need to trim it a little bit, but it's usually around 4 to 6 feet tall. It has white flowers in the spring. They don't smell. They're not fragrant. Glossy green leaves, good fall color, and fruit. And I was traveling. I was in South Dakota. I get to a very hearty group of gardeners there. And met some people, or was it Sioux City, Iowa? Somewhere in that tri-state area, someone has an Aronia farm, and they're harvesting the fruit because they're high in antioxidants.
Oh,
yeah. Now, if you've ever eaten them, I said you must add a lot of sugar to those things. So I don't know if that counteracts the good qualities, but the birds usually don't eat them until they fermented a little bit and softened over winter. So there's some winter impact. The birds eventually clean them up. They won't. They're edible, but they're not. You could eat them. They won't kill you, but I don't think you'd enjoy them. How's that? So those are two that come to mind. Black jet bead, Rhodotyphus, is one I'm seeing come back a little more into use. It's got white flowers. Kind of reminds me a little bit of a buttercup or a potentilla flower. Nice green leaves, and then it forms these little black seeds that look like blackberries almost, fruit. And I've seen it grow in really heavy shade under like oak trees and in a hosta garden and do very well. Caria, K-E-R-R-I-A, can take some shade. I'd probably put it lower on the list of plants to try. But those might be some things that you could give a shot and see if it would work for you. If you want a hedge-like plant, the viburnum or the aroni would be the first choice. If you want something a little more open, then you could do the black jet bead. It's a little more open and spilling the same. The caria kind of spreads. It's got beautiful chartreuse stems, yellow flowers, green leaves. Maybe a little denser shade than I've ever seen it use, but I've seen it. They've got some plantings at Old Brook that are in pretty heavy shade, too.
So good luck, Cecilia, and let us know how it all turns out.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Claire in Menominee Falls will turn to you now. Hi, Claire.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
The concern that we have, we're very fortunate to own 10 acres. Half of it is heavily wooded, and it goes to the Menominee River. And our herd population has been reduced through a deer management program that the DNR worked with our village government on. So the herd from 25 is now down to about maybe 14 or 15. So if they've eaten all the beautiful wildflowers and the shrubs that were in the woods, and it's all been replaced by garlic mustard. Both of my neighbors, you know, are not able to maintain the garlic mustard on their properties, which are about 3 acres and then 5 acres. So with, 5 acres of garlic mustard, I think I'd be a little bit insane to be pulling that every year. And now it's coming up to the gardens by the home. Any suggestions? Help?
The concern is if you spray, and some people are using Roundup, but repeat use of Roundup, there is some concern of the impact on the ecology of that whole area. And even though you're not seeing any of the spring ephemerals, they might be underneath. So if you do anything, you want to make sure that you're not getting those. And that's why a lot of people that are spraying are doing that in the fall. My concern about, I haven't really seen any good research on pre-emergence, but again, you might have seed for the wildflowers. So if you can get, what they're finding is once the garlic mustard is out, now, yeah, you've had the deer that were munching away, but there's probably a lot of seed in that ground. So if you can get rid of that garlic mustard, and hopefully the population won't come back by the time you get rid of the garlic mustard, it might be an option. You're right. 5 acres is a lot to pull. I don't know if this is something that, you know, because it's such a problem for all of us, that I don't know if you can enlist the help of somebody that might look at it as a community effort or your neighbors banding together. Because if you don't take care of it, your neighbors aren't going to get resolution. Yeah. And I really find that large gardening tasks, the older I get, the more I like to enlist my friends. We make it a social event. It's a day. We have fun. You know, a couple extra sets of hands make the bigger jobs seem a little less overwhelming. You know, it might be something that you might want to get some other people involved. I don't know of any easy way. And again, if you're spraying Roundup, you might be damaging some other plants. And so if you do that, what a lot of people will do will wipe it across the plants, you know, with like a foam brush or something, so that you're just putting it on the upper canopy. canopy, so if there is anything underneath, you're not damaging it. And people will often also do it in the fall when most of the spring wildflowers are gone, and so you have less impact too. But again, that would be my only solution. And spring gets to be almost as difficult as pulling.
Yep.
You know,
it does.
It's still time consuming. So I wish I had a good solution for you. This might be the time to put out a plea for help. And you know, this is a great job for kids. The other thing, if you are walking in a garlic infested area, make those your shoes that you always wear in that area, or clean them off, because you can bring the seeds back. A lot of the state parks have put boot brushes at the trailhead so that we don't tromp garlic mustard seeds in. But I've done a lot of garlic mustard pulls, and I'm in an area that there's not a lot of garlic mustard, and I found a few plants that I think the seeds might have been in the treads of my shoes, and I didn't get them out. So either clean carefully, or what I started doing after that was just, I have a pair of shoes that I put in a bag, leave them in the car, then take them off when I go into the area, and just don't use them anywhere else.
Thanks for calling, Claire, and good luck to you. It's a lot of work ahead of you there.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Donna in Madison, it is your turn. Hi, Donna.
Hi. I have questions. I have tulips and lilium from Holland that were sent to me by my son who was over there visiting. Now, I didn't open them in the winter. I just left them packaged and put them in the garage, covered up real well because it was winter yet. Now, I went out to plant some tulips yesterday, and an awful lot of them are moldy and soft, and some of those moldy ones do have sprouts on them. And I'm wondering if there's any point in planting those.
The ones that are soft and moldy have a good chance of rotting, okay?
Yeah.
So what you may want to do is pick out the ones that are better. You may even want to put them in a container as opposed to in the garden, and that way if they do turn to mush, one, it's easier to plant.
Yeah.
And two, if they turn to mush, you know, you haven't contaminated the rest of your soil if it's a root rot versus just, you know, decay from being in that bag. I would do that. And then if they grow and they thrive, I leave them in the container water till they naturally die back. And then here's what I do. If I'm ever saving forest bulbs, I put them in the garden right away, because I find if I hide them and put them in a cool, dark place for the rest of the summer, it's winter when I find them. And then I can't plant. And then I'm in the same boat you are. Then I've got these bulbs that, you know.
There was lots of snow out there.
Exactly. Lilies are a little pricier usually, and they're scaly bulbs. So if your lilies are kind of mushy and turned to rot, I would pull out the outer scales, like the cloves of garlic, and you could plant that main plant, or if you only have a good few solid scales, you can plant those. You'll get a tiny plant this year, and in 3 years, you'll have a flowering bulb. 3 to 4 years, you'll have a flowering bulb. And if you look up scaling, S-C-A-L-I-N-G-A, in a plant in a garden book or on the internet, they'll give you some good directions. People do it in baggies, people do it in flats, some people do it right in the garden. But, you know, I'd pot up the tulips in a container, and the lilies, you know, again, if there's just a few of the outer scales, I'd pull those off and plant the rest.
The lilium seems to be okay.
Excellent.
Yeah, good.
But that's the good. Tulips, I mean, and they both have to have full sun, don't they?
Yeah, especially, they'll take, you know, can you get them 6 hours, they'll be okay. And remember, especially the tulips, the sunlight in the spring is important. So, you know, the leaves aren't out on the tree. So a lot of times tulips, we can grow them in areas that are shady most of the year, but really nice and sunny before the trees leaf out.
Yeah. Let's see, I had another question. Oh, I guess that's...
That'll do it?
Oh, the sun.
Oh.
My vegetable garden, which I'm not going to plant all of this year, is part shade. It's all sun in the afternoon, but it's shade in the morning. Would that be okay to plant any of these in there?
Yeah, your tulips should be fine. Your lilies, I would give them as much sun as, you know, put them in the sunniest part. Keep in mind, tulips, we've been talking a lot about animals, so we might as well talk about deer and rabbits and tulips and lilies. Lilies are a favorite. It's like candy for deer.
Oh, no.
For deer and rabbits.
tulips that were a problem. But
no, they like lilies. They love lilies. So you just maybe, you know, in your vegetable garden, if you put a fence around it, that may be a good place
it's
for your lilies.
Fence, but my rabbits and squirrels jump right over it.
you need to add a little height to that. It won't help with the
then
squirrels.
Yeah, have to have a door to get into it.
Exactly.
I know.
It's always that. We love them and we hate them at the same time, don't we? Those bunnies are cute, but boy, when they eat our flowers, yes.
My neighbor loves them, and she doesn't have any plants to worry about.
Exactly. So it's easier to love them, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, best of luck, and give it a try, and let us know how it works for you.
Thanks, Donna. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. All right. Let's go to Kathy in Wrightstone. Hi, Kath.
Hi.
Hi, Kathy.
My question concerns potted pine trees. Neighbor and I planted about 20 potted pine trees latter part of the summer, early fall. Did a lot of watering with them, but through the course of the winter, the needles have gotten brown tips. Is that permanent until those needles fall off and the new needles are going to be nice and green, or is there any hope for the older needles on the trees?
How did you overwinter those potted pines? Did you heal them in?
They were just purchased as potted ones, but planted right directly into the ground.
Oh, they're in the ground. Okay, they're not in containers anymore. Okay.
No, they're not containers anymore. Did it more or less as a hedge.
Okay, kind of. Okay. It was a tough winter. We had good snow cover, which is always a plus, but I used more salt on my sidewalk than I think I've used in the last 10 years. And I shovel first, but I had so much ice. So a couple things. We're seeing salt damage. We're seeing salt damage on needles. Wind, evergreens, their roots are frozen, but they lose moisture through their needles, so the winter winds can be very drying. Transplant shock, even if you do everything right, you know, it's an adjustment for the plant. And depending on what happened beforehand and how they were managed, hopefully they were cared for in a good manner. It was a pretty dry summer. And, you know, when we cut our Christmas trees in October, we don't see them brown until after they've sat in the house for a while and dried out. So sometimes, you know, they can be stressed beforehand. So probably transplant stress. You're right. Those needles tips will stay brown. But the new growth, if everything is fine, will be okay. So if it was winter damage, then the new growth will be fine. If it's a lack of moisture, you know, it's still getting established. Trees take a couple years to get established. We usually think one season, okay, they're done, they're on their own. But, you know, give them proper care always, but definitely give them extra attention with the watering and mulch. You know, mulch around the base and then water thoroughly whenever the top few inches of soil is kind of crumbly and moist, and that'll give them the best edge. I would wait to fertilize. Usually we like our trees in the ground 1 year before fertilizing. They'll get the best benefit, and then you reduce the risk of damaging any of those tender new roots. So I think you have a good shot at it. I think it was winter injury. You look at established plants, I'm seeing a lot of brown tips, and I think it was just the winter. It was pretty tough.
Okay, great.
Good Thank luck you. With those. You
yeah,
bet.
Thanks, Kathy. Mary Ann in Viroqua, on to you. Hi.
Hi.
Hi, Mary Ann.
Hi. Maybe 3 to 4 years ago, we planted 8 fruit trees and made the huge mistake of mulching with sawdust. And I've just heard, like, this year that we shouldn't have done that. I'm wondering whether or not I need to remove that or whether the damage is already done. I was down there like 2 days ago looking at it and looking at them and digging in that sawdust, and it almost looks like it's been totally composted. It looks black.
Yeah. Sawdust is, as long as it wasn't treated with a preservative or something, but if sounds like it's been there for a while, you would have seen the damage already. The problem with sawdust is, like any of our wood products, is they're slow to break down. So if it's wood that hasn't been treated with a preservative that's harmful to plants or the environment, the only thing you need to be concerned about is you may need to add some nitrogen if you're not getting good growth. But if you're getting decent growth, fruit trees need minimal. We over-fertilize them. You don't get flowers and you don't get fruit. So
They are not doing well. In fact, we've replaced, I think, 2 or 3 of them already, and I think we have another 1 or 2 that are dead.
Have you had anybody diagnose the problem?
Yeah, it might not be the sawdust.
Right, exactly. What I would suggest doing, and like you said, it's already starting to decompose and break down. Once it breaks down, it adds the nitrogen that it temporarily robbed back to the soil.
Oh.
So I'm guessing what they were concerned about is the temporary type of nitrogen, or if there were preservatives that were hurting the trees.
No, there shouldn't have been any preservatives in
okay.
it.
So did you mulch it right up to the tree?
We left a gap of
great.
A few inches.
That's mm-hmm. excellent. So, and a couple of inches of sawdust, 3, 2, 1?
I would say like maybe up to 5.
Okay, the finer the mulch, like sawdust, the thinner the layer. So next time, 1 to 2 inches, no more. 3 to 4 is what we do with wood chips and shredded bark. They're bigger and coarser. I'm with Larry. I think your problem might be something other than the sawdust. And what I would suggest is if you've got one, you might want to either take it to your extension office. You know, I'll tell you, the internet is wonderful. Mm. What I like to do is, you know, somebody will say, oh, it sounds, you know, blah, 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 I've got this. I'm like, oh, it sounds like this disease. Go check it. And there's such great photos that you can confirm my diagnosis mm-hmm. over the radio. But, you know, you might want to talk about fruit decline. Check with your extension office and see if they've take samples if you've got something that's showing the symptoms. You know, if it's dead, it's dead, and that may yeah. be all they can tell you. But if it's like stunted, or are the leaves discolored or spotted, or a branch mm-hmm. is dying, a branch at a time, like fire blight can move yeah. through a planting pretty readily, where the branches turn black and the end curls up. And if you prune into that and you prune into a healthy branch, you spread the disease. So I'm not sure I made you feel better, but you didn't do anything wrong with the sawdust. I really don't. I really would be surprised if it was the sawdust. I think you've got some other problem happening there.
Does black walnut affect fruit trees?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, we cut one of them down last fall. That was close.
Yeah, and it does, and that could be it, and especially if it's very spotty. And what happens is you've cut it down, those roots, as they decompose, once they're decomposed, you won't have problems with the jug loan anymore. But in the short term, any roots and debris that's in the soil can cause problems. So
it's going to be a few years.
It's going to be a few years, but that would be a very good chance that was the black walnut.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
And don't use those wood chips. Put those someplace to compost, and then use them once it's composted someplace around plants that you know are resistant, just to be sure.
Thanks, Mary Ann. And Terry and Abrams, your turn. Hi, Terry.
Yeah, hi there. I just thought I'd make a quick comment. Everybody, when you mentioned the use of salt in icy areas during the winter and all the pollution that salt's, you know, putting into our environment, what I use in place of that is buy chicken grits. Go to either a farmer co-op, a Fleet Farm store, you buy these 40 or 50 pound bags of chicken grits.
Mm-hmm.
And preferably get the dark chicken grits, because when you have sunny days, when we start to get our sun back, it kind of absorbs the sun and then starts to also help break the ice down. But chicken grits gives you a grip, and it doesn't make that mess like salt. Yeah.
Well, thank you. That's a great tip. I know Madison uses sand and salt combination, just sand. One thing to always be aware of, and one thing is, where's that product going? Because we do worry about our storm sewers filling up with product. But you're right. What a great way to get traction, not be as harmful to the environment, and perhaps sweep it up at the end of the season and put it in a bucket and reuse it next year to keep it out of the storm sewer. So thank you for that tip. And I know a lot of people are looking at corn products as well and some more environmentally friendly products. So thanks for that tip.
And Tim and Madison, your turn. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Good. My question concerns, back in the fall, when winter was starting here, I covered up a rose bush and some hardy mums that had just been planted earlier in the fall. The rose bush has been there for a couple of years. The hardy mums was just planted last fall, and I covered them up with a plastic bag and mulch just to, you know, protect them for over the winter. And I'm wondering, how soon do I need to
take that off?
Is now a good time? Should I wait a couple weeks? What's your thoughts on that? And I do have a follow-up question, but go ahead.
Okay, great question. As our temperatures are consistently hovering around freezing, which I know can happen one day and not the next, but seems like we're there, hopefully. We're staying around freezing. This is the time we start pulling our mulch off. Plastic ice makes me a little nervous because it can heat up and hold the moisture. So I would definitely, it sounded like you put plastic over it, or mulch over the plastic, but I would get the plastic off as soon as possible, and then you can slowly pull that mulch back. Now, your mums will have died back to the ground. That's normal. Your roses hopefully didn't, but I looked at some of my hardy roses. I don't mulch mine, and I'm going to be doing a little pruning this year on a few, but I know that the base will be fine and intact, so don't give up if you've got a lot of dead canes. Prune out what's dead, you know, kind of shape as needed, and then wait, because often they'll sprout from above the graft if it's grafted, but below ground.
And Tim, we don't have time for your second question. I'm sorry.
Sorry about that, Tim. Best of luck, though.
Thank you, Melinda.
Thanks, Larry. It's always a pleasure.
We'll look forward to your next visit.
Me
Appreciate
too.
It very much. Melinda Myers, our guest, host of the PBS television show Great Lakes Gardener. Go to her website again at melindamyers.com. Find out about her books and lots of other great information about gardening. Just to let you know that on Monday, our personal computer consultant, Peter Green, will be joining us, and he has some advice and his monthly top 10 websites. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.